So welcome everyone to a Clear Mountain interview, and today we're joined by Joseph Goldstein. Joseph, thank you so much for taking the time.
Yeah, a real pleasure.
So not that maybe everyone needs an introduction to Joseph, but here's the bio. Joseph Goldstein has been leading insight and loving kindness meditation retreats worldwide since 1974. He is a co-founder of the Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts, where he is on the Guiding Teachers Founders Council. In 1989, together with several other teachers and students of Insight Meditation, he helped establish the Barre Center for Buddhist Studies. Joseph first became interested in Buddhism as a Peace Corps volunteer in Thailand in 1965. Since 1967, he has studied and practiced different forms of Buddhist meditation under eminent teachers from India, Burma, and Tibet. He is the author of Mindfulness, A Practical Guide to Awakening, One Dharma, The Emerging Western Buddhism, The Experience of Insight, among others. And Joseph is also a primary teacher in the 10% Happier app of Dan Harris. And a special thank you to Steve Wilhelm for connecting us with him. So Joseph, once again, we kind of acknowledge the Dharma landscape we stepped into when we returned to the US was really cultivated by you and that first wave of teachers. And your teachings have meant a lot to us, and we were just so grateful that you took the time.
Great.
All right. So we didn't know exactly what would be the best question to begin with, but I thought it might be most elegant to start with asking you about your teachers, and specifically Munindraji, sorry. And I wondered if you might talk about how you came to be his disciple, and either what the first moment that you really found yourself having faith in him was, or any other stories of inspiration which might really allow mm-hmm. people to get a feel for this teacher who meant so much to you.
Yeah. So I first had my first introduction to Buddhism when I was in the Peace Corps in Thailand. I was teaching English in Bangkok, and that was really my first connection with the teachings. When I finished my Peace Corps time, I had really made a deep connection, with the teachings, even though I didn't have, hardly had any meditative experience. It was just very beginning. So when I returned to the States, I realized I wanted to pursue it and that I needed a teacher. And this was in, 1967. I didn't know of any Buddhist teachers in this country at that time. There was not much going on in that realm, at least as far as I was aware of. So I decided to go back to Asia, thinking that I would go back to Thailand, but friends had been in India and had met some Tibetan teachers. And so I stopped in India on the way to what I thought would be my eventual destination in Thailand. And I traveled around. I looked for some of those Tibetan teachers and didn't make that connection. And after quite a bit of traveling, I ended up in Bodh Gaya, where Munindraji had just returned from, I think it was 8 or 9 years of practice and study in Burma. And actually, he said something when I first met him that it was the hook. And it was just the most simple statement. He said, if you want to understand your mind, sit down and observe it. That was all. There was nothing to join. There was no ritual. There was no ceremony, nothing. And I just so appreciated the common sense-ness of it, because how else can we understand our minds except by sitting down and observing it? So I knew there was just that immediate connect. Oh, yes, this is what I've been looking for. And then when he started teaching and laid out the path of Vipassana practice, I realized it's exactly what I was looking for. It just felt like coming home. And he was really a wonderful teacher. He was very open-minded. He wasn't the kind of teacher who held on to his students or thought this was the only way. Very open-minded, which I really appreciated a lot. In those times, especially the early years when I was practicing in India and other Westerners had started to come and sit with Munindraji. And often they would want to go and travel around India, meet other teachers, Hindu saints, you know, the whole range of what's available in India. And he had a wonderful attitude. He encouraged people to go. He never tried to prevent them, because he said, the Dharma doesn't suffer in comparison to anything. He had so much faith and confidence in the Buddhist teachings, and it just, you know, it conveyed that. He said, go and explore and see. And that open-mindedness, I really appreciate having been the foundation of my own practice, especially now, you know, coming back to the West and there's so many traditions and teachers and and just to have an open-minded attitude toward it all seems really valuable. So a lot of that comes from Munindraji.
Thank you, Joseph. And to follow up on that question, there's two things I'd be interested in. One, if you had to sort of single out the most meaningful act of love or metta that you ever saw Munindraji engage in, if there's one story that came to your mind, or even a small one that just kind of pops up, then I would be interested. But also, speaking of those other teachers, I'd be curious about your experience of the being Deepa Ma and what your encounters with her were like.
Well, I'll start with her because she... Somebody once asked her what was in her mind. So for those who might not be familiar with her, she was this extraordinary yogi. She had been living in Burma when... This was still when it was part of the British Empire, the British Raj. And she had a lot of personal suffering in her life. At one point, two of her three children had died. Her husband died. So it was devastating. And she said that she was basically in grief for years, you know. And at one point, some friends of hers said, you must go to the monastery. You must learn meditation because you could die from this grief. It was so overwhelming. So she went to the monastery of the Venerable Mahasi Sayadaw, big monastery in Yangon, formerly Rangoon, where Munindraji was teaching. And both Deepa Ma and Munindraji were Bengali by birth. So they had the common Bengali language. So he became her teacher. And he would tell many stories of her because she was so extraordinary. Within a very short period of time, she had achieved to realize different stages of awakening, of enlightenment, and then also developed tremendous depth of concentration of samadhi very quickly. And then attendant, you know, on the strength of her samadhi, developed all the kind of psychic powers that you read about in the texts. And because she had such an natural affinity for it, Munindraji trained her in all of that. Partly, I think, because he wanted to see, is it actually true? You know, you read about these fantastic stories of what can be done with the mind. And so he trained her in all that as well. And he loved to tell stories about all this. Deepa Ma herself hardly ever spoke about that aspect.
Do you have one for us, Joseph?
Pardon?
Do you have one for us, Joseph?
A story. Well, it's going to sound unbelievable to people. I mean, I think the story is going to engender a lot of skepticism. For example, Munindraji said that he'd be sitting in his room and sometimes Deepa Ma would just appear through the wall, come into his room and be with him in the wall, through the wall in his room. Another time there was a professor at a local university who was very skeptical about all these powers. So the university was, I don't know, a couple of miles away from Munindraji's room. So Munindraji set up this experiment where a student of the professor, and Munindra and Deepama were sitting in his room, Munindraji's room. The professor was in his office a couple of miles away. And then through these powers of mind, while sitting in Munindraji's room, she appeared in the room of the professor 2 miles away. You know, so again, these are things that to a Western mind, hard to believe, you know, and often very skeptical about it. But what's interesting to me is that these, first, let me back up a minute. It's to emphasize the fact that while these powers are fascinating, they really don't have much to do with awakening or enlightenment. So they are a capacity of the mind, but the Buddha did not consider them important. And I think that's really important to emphasize. So it's fun to talk about them because they're so unusual, and to you know, be with somebody who has had these experiences. But I think we don't want to take our eye off the real goal of practice, which is not that. Mm-hmm. So she was just this extraordinary, extraordinary being. Somebody once asked her what was in her mind, and she said, peace, concentration, and love. That's what was in her mind. That's a nice mind to have, you know. And in terms of the experience of a being manifesting that level of metta, of loving kindness, in a way, that was her most powerful transmission. You know, so we would go visit her in Calcutta, or she would sometimes come to Bodh Gaya. You know, in Indian fashion, we'd go in and pay respects, and she would just bless us. You know, she would run her hands over our head and shoulder, just blessing us with metta. And it was amazing. It was a blissful feeling of receiving that quality of unconditional love, unconditional metta. She was a tremendous inspiration to me, you know, just somebody who had cultivated her heart and mind to that extent. Munindraji was much quirkier. So he was very loving. And but I'll just tell one little quirky story. So we were living in Bodh Gaya, and very often, you know, I'd accompany him to the local bazaar. And one time I saw him, I want to just back up a minute. One of the phrases he used a lot, just as encouragement to a certain attitude in practice, he just said this so often. He said, be simple and easy about things. Just be simple and easy about the practice, about your life. Okay, so I heard that thousands of times. Okay, back to the bazaar. So I'm in the bazaar with him, and he starts bargaining intensively for, like, I don't know, 5 cents worth of peanuts. And he's engaging with the peanut vendor, as Indians can do when they get into bargaining mode. So I said to Munindraji, I said, Munindraji, you often talk about, you know, being simple and easy. Why are you bargaining so much for this, you know, handful of peanuts? And his response was, I said to be simple, not to be a simpleton. So that was Munindraji. I mean, he was very quirky. In a delightful way, you know, and always there was a Dharma teaching involved. So it was great. It was great studying with his open-mindedness. And his care. He had tremendous care for all of his students.
Beautiful, beautiful stories of transmission.
Yeah.
Makes you wish there was a camera, or if there was Zoom at that time. You have deep on different Zoom cameras that would be
awesome
in different rooms.
Yeah.
To bring it back to what you highlighted earlier is just awakening. This might be somewhat earlier in your bio, but I've heard you talk about what you call an experience of zero. And it sounds like an experience which had implications for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. I think I would love to hear you talk about this probably for a long time, but could you just say what was that experience of zero and what implications did it have on your life?
So this happened when I was still in the Peace Corps, right at the end of my Peace Corps stay, where I had already begun just basic meditation, but I had not done any intensive practice. I was just learning, really, but studying a lot and really interested in the teachings. And at one point, I was with a friend who was teaching through the British Council, an English guy, and he was also very interested in this. And one afternoon, we were just sitting in the garden of his house, and he was reading from a Tibetan text, which I later found out was a poor translation of that particular text. But at the time, I didn't know that. And in those days, it was by this translator, Evans Wentz. And so this goes back to the 60s. So his books were quite popular. Then he had a book on the Tibetan Book of the Dead. But the text that my friend was reading from in his translation was called the Tibetan Book of the Great Liberation. So I'm sitting in the garden, we're both sitting, he's reading from this text. And for some reason, my mind just settled into a really concentrated place. It just settled in. It was very, very still. And the text, the refrain in the text was, look within your own mind. And then it would give some teachings. Look within your own mind. So this was repeated many times. And so I was sitting in that very quiet space, and this was the instruction. So I was looking in my own mind, and then it began to describe the quality of the free mind, or the nature of mind, you know, unformed, unconstructed, unfabricated, words like that. And then part of that litany of words describing the mind was unborn. And for whatever reason, I heard the word unborn, and my mind just opened to the unborn, you know, which of course I was all new to this, so I didn't really have a major conceptual framework for any of it. So the way I just, and it was just like a lightning bolt. I mean, it was like, so the way I described it to myself in the moment, because it came as such a surprise, it was just like a radical shift as being the experience of zero, you know. And just a little side note here. It's very interesting, I think, to reflect on what the term unborn means, because we do come across that term a lot in different Buddhist texts and traditions. And I've come to understand that the term unborn can be understood in two different ways. And in a way, the two different understandings of unborn reflect some of the differences in the different Buddhist traditions. So one meaning of unborn would mean never born as always existing. Right? It was never born, it's just always been existing. Another meaning of unborn is unarisen. Right, something that's has not been born, has not yet arisen. So that was the experience that I had had of that reality. You could kind of say the reality of non-being, right? So that non-being is not nothing. That non-being is its own reality. It's very hard to talk about this stuff, but I hope you're getting at least some flavor of it. And so the result of that moment was kind of the deeply transformative understanding of selflessness, because it was like the experience of the zero center rather than the self center. So it was completely transformative and discombobulating at the moment, because it's sort of just, because it didn't happen in the context of, you know, a long training period or anything like that. It was just like a sudden surprise, you know. So it was very discombobulating to, there's no self. What do I do? What does this not self do? You know, it was like, I don't know, getting turned inside out or something.
Joseph, you, in another interview, you spoke about after this experience, or maybe even in the moment of that experience, some level of doubt or a particular kind of doubt was abandoning you. What, if that's accurate, what is that type of doubt? What is the kind of surety?
I missed what you said about the doubt.
Oh yeah, I think I had heard in another interview that in connection with this experience, you had some aspect of doubt had been abandoned in yourself or fallen away.
Yeah, it's the doubt about non-self. You know, because in that experience, it's like if you put your hand in fire, you have no doubt that it burns. You know, in the experience of the zero center, the doubt, and kind of in Buddhist terminology, one might call it the wrong view of self. Hmm. You know, so that really was abandoned, uprooted. But because it happened the way it did, so that was right at the end of my Peace Corps stay, within like 2 weeks of going home. I mean, so here I went, you know, after 2 years there teaching English, and then I'm on a plane back to America. I had no idea what to do with all of this. You know, it was just such a different perspective and understanding. And of course, nobody here in the States had any idea what I was talking about.
Joseph, actually, you know, I've heard people speak about experiences like this before, and one of the things that's come up is a real dearth of teachers who can guide practice in after experiences like this. Is there something, you know, particularly unique about practicing after one has had such experiences, or navigate, like you said, it was like being turned inside out. Is there anything in particular that you might say to someone who's experienced something similar and trying to navigate their practice?
Yeah, well, I think the particular difficulty for me was that that experience didn't happen in the context of working with a teacher, or even in the context of an established meditation practice. So it was just a bit unusual in that way, and who knows, you know, some karmic thing. Who knows, you know, to explain why and how it happened. But I think for most people, it will happen in the context of a training. So it's a lot easier to understand and then to be guided, because really the practice remains the same. you know, it's just, okay, continue the practice. And because in some way that's the beginning, not the end, you know. And so, and for myself in particular, because it didn't happen in the context of a long training, it's almost like when I went back to India and met Muninja and started teaching, it's almost like I had to catch up to the experience, you know, and develop, you know, all the qualities of the mind that can be cultivated in meditation. But generally, when people have a similar experience in their practice, it generally doesn't have quite the discombobulation that it had for me, because it's all in context. The guidance really is just to keep people practicing, and there are some specific details, but it generally is not problematic.
Joseph, you said in your experience, for most people, when they experience like this kind of awakening experience, it occurs in the context of a training. I'm curious, how frequent is that? How often do you meet someone who you feel has had this kind of genuine awakening experience? Is it once a month? Is it once a year? Is it, have you met just a handful in your life, or?
I never counted. it's not once a week, you know, or anything like that. But let me say, it's not impossible. That there are quite a few people, you know, who in the course of their practice have touched this. So again, I'll back up a minute. There's a whole spectrum of understandings of selflessness, you know. So there are many places along the way that have deeply transformative consequences or results. So this is one particular one that really does uproot, you know, that belief in self. So there's no doubt. But even before that, people can have very significant realizations of selflessness. So again, I think it's helpful to just see that there's a whole spectrum of insights that happen in the course of practice. And also people can have this experience and describe it in different ways. So that is also interesting to begin as a teacher, you know, to hear people describe different experiences and to get a sense of, well, exactly what is it? And something our teacher Saira Upandita would say very often, that only the Buddha can know for sure. Yeah, so in terms of a teacher, you know, confirming something definitively, he was always reluctant to do that, even though he had great mastery in understanding the whole path. But I really appreciate that, and I've seen that in myself and in my own teaching. You know, the mind can get to very subtle experiences. And sometimes it's hard to know exactly what it is. And so for me, the bottom line in terms of, I don't know what we could call stages of awakening, really has to do with the uprooting of defilements. That becomes the measure rather than the report than simply the report on a particular experience, because sometimes it is hard to tell. But the fruit of kind of a genuine experience will be the uprooting of different defilements at, in different stages. So that, that can be a test over time. You know, has this really been transformative in that way or not?
Thank you, Joseph. And thank you for wandering into difficult waters to speak about it. But I think it does mean a lot to people to hear about, you know, the path. And one thing is people, you're right, and I have, you know, we hear about different teachers experiencing various things. And often this really can lend itself to a somewhat nebulous articulation of like non-duality and other things. But one thing I think, at least I've really appreciated about your teachings is you hold that tension or that paradox between the conventional and the transcendent so well, in that you really honor the Buddha, his teachings, him as a teacher. You know, you've done years of teachings on the Satipatthana. And so this is another kind of strange question, but as you come to the, you know, sort of
the latter part of my life.
I was phrasing it delicately. As you come to the latter part of your life, how is your relationship to the Buddha and the Dharma changed these years? How do you conceive of that unifying thread through life? Because it's touching to talk to you now after a life given to this dispensation.
Yeah. You know, even from the very beginning, I really connected with the classical teachings. Because to me, they were just so clear. You know, the Buddhist description of the mind and the truth of suffering and the causes of it and the end of it, you know, the Eightfold Path, it's just so brilliantly clear. So that's always been the bedrock of my understanding, of my teachings. So I mean, this is probably not exactly in response to your question, but so I've been doing my own self-retreat now every year for 50 years. I mean, it's something I do every year. And in recent years, instead of reading the texts, I've been listening to them. They're all on Audible. The suttas, it's amazing. You know, and they're read. Who's ever reading it does a really skillful job. And what I found is that hearing them, they go in differently than reading. You know, and so I've really appreciated on my retreats, it's like the Buddha is giving the Dharma talk, you know, because I'm listening to the suttas. And it does take a little patience because, as you know, there's a lot of repetition in the suttas, which when you're reading, you can just kind of skip over. But if you're listening, but one gets used to it and, you know, just relaxes into the repetition. And in a way, it can be helpful. But the reason I'm mentioning this is it really changed the way I relate to Buddha images. You know, so I have a little meditation room, you know, with a statue of the Buddha. And for years, you know, before each teaching, I would take refuge. But for many years, like taking refuge in the Buddha, it was in some kind of abstract notion of the Buddha, you know, kind of an abstraction of an enlightened being. But after all these years of listening to the Buddha addressing monks and nuns and lay people, I really got a sense of him as a living being talking to people, right? So now when I take, you know, before I sit, pay respects, take refuge, it's almost like I put myself in the scene that I had listened to in the suttas. You know, so it's as if the Buddha is a person speaking to me. Does this make any sense? So it just becomes much more personal. Yeah.
I was going to say, Joseph, it resonates so deeply with us. I mean, this is all the hopes. And just to hear you speak about this is actually very touching. So please.
Yeah. Well, that's basically it. But it was interesting to me in terms of, I was speaking first of how I related to the classical teachings, but this is also, there's been a transformation of how I relate to the idea of the Buddha. And it's just gotten more and more immediate, you know, which is, it's beautiful. And in that can really, I just have the sense of his great compassion in all those years of teaching and very often saying the same thing over and over and over again to these people who, you know, of course they were great enlightened beings, but there were also a lot of ordinary people who needed to hear it over and over and over again. So just feeling the compassion, you know, of spending all this time teaching in that way is beautiful.
Joseph, that's a fantastic explanation of how your relationship to the Triple Gem has changed.
Yeah.
I'm curious, so you mentioned, you know, your relationship to Buddha statues and relationship to teachings in general. And I'm curious about your relationship to the Sangha, how that has changed. I mean, we're monks and you're being, you know, very nice and respectful with us. And, you know, Upandita was one of your teachers. But largely, I mean, you live, you know, you've founded a number of different lay meditation centers. And there are monastics that go and teach there. And Bhante Inalio lives there on the grounds somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm curious, how do you relate to that Sangha gym these days?
Well, as you say, I mean, Sisaida Upandita was a very significant teacher for me. So there was a very kind of deep connection there. But in terms of how I relate now, I think what's most predominant and very meaningful of all the different paramis, for myself, I would say renunciation is not at the top. And yet, I appreciate the power of it. And so the way I think of and relate to and hold the Sangha, the monastic Sangha, I really have a tremendous respect and just appreciation of the purity that comes from the level of monastic renunciation when it's held well. You know, and to me there's, so when I'm around monastics, you know, who are really good, it's almost like a contact high of purity. You know, it's like I try to kind of just have it imbue me a little bit and inspire perhaps a little more renunciation. But because that's a powerful aspect, because the Buddha talked about it so much, and yet it's not really a Western value particularly, you know. So it's inspiring to me.
Joseph, I've been impressed. So I've listened to your whole basic course on 10% Happier, as well as the phrases for stress. And two of the phrases for stress are around this theme. It says, meditation isn't a bubble bath. That's one phrase. And another one is that lust cracks the brain.
Lust cracks the brain.
Lust cracks the brain.
That's from a translation of a teaching Sayadaw Pandita gave.
I so appreciate your willingness to even mention that. I mean, like,
oh absolutely.
It's great and it's accessible. I meditated this morning with my mom using, you know, your guided meditation, and, but your willingness to bring up renunciation and talking about lust directly as being a hindrance to a peaceful mind, that's something that people can avoid. Could you say something more about that?
Well, first to say, so Sayadaw Pandita was giving a Dharma talk, and he was going on and on in Burmese. Yeah, it maybe spoke for 10 minutes before it was translated. And then all the translators said to translate the 10 minutes worth of talk was lust cracks the brain, which I totally loved because it's true. I mean, everyone is a human being. Lust is there, you know, and that's happily for most people, it does get less naturally as one ages. but you know, still there, but certainly at certain stages in life, it's a powerful energy, you know, and people feel energized by it. And yet, if it's not handled skillfully, as we all know, it can be cause of tremendous amount of suffering. So I think it's really important to talk about it and to give people, to remind people of how powerful the energy is and how it really, if we're on a spiritual path, it really requires understanding it and managing it in a skillful way, which will be different, of course, for monastics or for lay people, but still there are guidelines in every situation. One of the parts of the meditation that have been so revealing to me about our relationship or our understanding of desire in the mind, and I'll talk about this often on retreats, I really encourage people when they're meditating and some kind of lustful fantasy or desire, just desire in general even, wanting mind, you know, is really strong. So I encourage people just to be with it, just to be watching that it's happening, and to notice what it feels like. And it's often associated with some pleasure, which is what the hook is. But then I suggest to people, if we're just watching it, it will go away by itself eventually, because everything changes, everything arises and passes. So I encourage people to really pay attention to that moment when it disappears. So desire, wanting, and then not wanting. And to see what that mind feels like. And in that moment, the comparison between the two becomes easy. You know, if we're this is what it felt like when I was, you know, filled with desire, and this is what it feels like when it's gone. And for me, it always feels like it's being let out of the grip of something, you know, into ease, into relaxation, into peace. And I encourage people to do this so they see it for themselves. So it's not just you hear the teaching, oh yeah, this is, you know, give up desire or whatever. But people can see, you know, the effect in the mind as they pay attention in this way. And I find that for myself, it's been really helpful. That not wanting is more fun than wanting. But that's not the message we get in our lives.
You should make a t-shirt. That'd be great. Yes. So, Joseph, if lust cracks the mind, one obstacle I think a lot of practitioners we know, and Ajahn Sona will say many people have one foot in the monastery and one foot on a banana peel. And what I take that to mean is many people do, you know, they have a different sort of wanting of Dhamma Chanda, you know, zeal for the Dhamma. They touch this truth and feel its power. And yet there's this, maybe not a full-on crack of the mind like lust, but just the steady leakage of their dharma, energy and path and dilution of a life. And I think for someone who's really trying to walk the path sincerely, but has duties and family and job, that small lack of alignment, however minor it might seem, can really kind of eat at someone over time. So as someone who's really embodied in, you know, the Dhamma in a lay life, what guidance or words would you have for people who are trying to live out this path with integrity and integration in a lay context?
A few things come to mind. I mean, one which we've alluded to already in terms of renunciation, but in terms of a lay life, I think really a commitment as far as possible to the five precepts, you know, is just seems really foundational, you know, and that's a commitment that anybody could make, you know, and even if they're not fulfilled perfectly, but still a commitment to them can be there. And if one finds one has broken a precept in some way, just to retake it and begin again, and really understanding them as rules of training, but to take it seriously. So I'll just give one example, which it's always surprising to me. So I try to follow all of the precepts, and mostly do pretty good. But the one that I really, the precept of not killing, there's no ambiguity about that, you know, so I really try to practice that as impeccably as possible, you know, and there are some situations, living a household life, you know, carpenter answer, eating your house, what do you do? But I really try to be quite impeccable about not killing even like ants or mosquitoes or spiders, things like that. And first, it really establishes a certain kind of rapport, even with those beings, you know, that one might find distasteful or annoying or whatever, to begin to relate to them as beings, you know, who want to live. And what surprises me is I have a lot of friends, and even some who, you know, are Dharma practitioners, but wouldn't think anything of just squatting a mosquito, you know, or killing it. And it's just interesting to me that has become so much the norm in our society that to take that precept is significant, you know, and so that's, for a lay person, that actually is a significant aspect of Dharma practice. Just that one little thing, don't kill, you know, whenever possible. So the precepts, and one could talk about each of the precepts in this way. So I think that's really foundational. The second piece, which I feel is really important, is just the daily practice, you know, and people live in different circumstances. For some people, it might be half an hour a day, or an hour, or a little less, a little more, a lot more. People can find what works for them, but I think it's the regularity of a daily practice, which is really helpful. And the practice does deepen, even from just a daily practice, you know, even without doing retreats. But then if we add, you know, some retreat time each year, that again kind of turbocharges the practice. So there are all these different ways. one other suggestion that I would have for people, which I think people often overlook. You know, when people come on retreat, we teach sitting meditation, walking meditation, and being mindful of everything else. Generally, I find that people create a hierarchy, that sitting's the real deal. Walking, yeah, secondary, and everything else comes in a distant third. So sometimes I'll just suggest to people just to reverse the order. But particularly I want to emphasize the walking meditation as a practice, because of course on retreat it's done in quite a formal way. But having done it, I don't know, for thousands of hours in my life, I find that the walking practice is what carries over the most into my daily life. And from having done so much walking meditation, now it's almost the default. I take a step and just automatically, you know, just there's awareness of the step. So one could be in the middle of New York City or just in one's house going about one's business. If one has really cultivated the walking practice, that is a way of suffusing the day with mindfulness, because generally we move a lot. You know, we're taking many steps in a day. So that's another way of really bringing a depth of practice into a daily lay life. So there are all these things. You know, there's the precepts and daily practice, walking.
Thank you. Yeah, on that last note of walking, I recently heard you give instructions, which I'd never heard before, of basically suggesting that people start a session of practice with, say, 10 minutes of walking meditation mm-hmm. before sitting. That was really helpful advice.
It can be, because often people spend the first 10 minutes of a sitting just trying to settle the mind.
Right.
Whereas the walking, in a way, it's easier because the movements are so tangible, you know, and so for many people, it's actually easier to be mindful in walking. So then when they go and sit, they're already somewhat settled, somewhat concentrated.
I wanted to maybe shift the discussion in the direction of your efforts and work to bring the Dharma to the West, to America. And in your book, One Dharma, which is a great book, you've got two chapters in there on what you've been talking about recently, about giving up that which is wrong, i.e. keeping the precepts, and then doing what's good in the various different ways that we do it.
Yeah.
In the preface to that, you have a series of questions that you kind of put out there, which I thought were quite fascinating, kind of pointing to the paradoxes of practicing Dharma and bringing Dharma to the West. And just two of the questions you ask are, how much of our spiritual practice and discipline is embedded in cultural overlays from the East that are neither relevant nor helpful in our Western society? And a follow-up question, and do we sometimes water down or even leave behind the essence of the teachings simply because they take us out of our Western physical or psychological comfort zone? So how do you balance that, the taking the pith, figuring out what the pith is from these the different traditions that have arisen in Asia as you bring them to the West?
Well, in one way, it's very simple. But then footnotes to that simplicity could get very complex. the basic simplicity, the Buddha expressed it over and over again, very clearly and very simply. He talked about liberation through non-clinging. In reading the sutras, I mean, that just is there in one form or another, you know, throughout. And so to really, if one can take that in a deep way, it really can inform the practice. And it goes back to an earlier question you raised. Can't exactly remember the question, but I remember what my response was going to be, but it's tied to non-clinging. And this is true both, I think, of monastics or lay people, it's just people on the path. It's so easy to be practicing for something, right? For some more concentrated state or for some idea of awakening or whatever. And not realize that the way to the aspiration we may have is by letting go. It's not by that reaching for. So that's really helpful because it gets people, it frees them a bit from the tremendous hindrance of expectation. And I like to make the distinction between expectation and aspiration. You know, because aspirations are wonderful. You know, we can have an aspiration for awakening, for enlightenment, for greater love and compassion. So the aspiration sets the direction. Expectation is that wanting things to be a certain way when we want them. That, of course, anybody who's done any kind of practice will know that expectation is a setup for suffering. Because one of the, as you well know, one of the meanings of anatta, or selflessness, one of the implications of that is the ungovernable nature. Things are following their own laws. As the great realization is that we're not making the laws. You know? And so expectation just is a setup for frustration and discouragement. And so to really let, to see the difference between aspiration and expectation, I think can be a tremendous help to people in settling back into the essence of what frees the mind, which is not clinging. There's one line from the suttas where the Buddha said, "Nothing whatsoever is to be clung to as I or mine." You know, whoever has heard this has heard all the teachings. And he goes on. So it's just so simple, but it reinforces the idea that it's about the letting go, not the grasping for.
Thank you.
Ramana Maharshi, the great Indian sage, he had a great line. He said, "Try to be less, not more." Mm. You know, but generally in our lives, we're trying to be more instead of less.
I'm curious. I love that quote: "Sabbe dhamma nalang abhinivesaya." No dhamma is worthy clinging to.
Yeah.
But I'm curious, I have heard this teaching, I've loved it a lot in the past, because it, which is just this idea that on the level of wisdom, nothing is to be clung to. I think this is sometimes attributed to Ajahn Mahabua, is that on the level of wisdom, you don't cling to anything, but, or you don't hold to anything. Whereas on the level of sila or morality and the level of samadhi or concentration, you need to hold to something. You need to hold your principles. I'm someone who doesn't kill. I'm someone who doesn't.
Yeah, I think this is not parsing the language carefully enough, because there's a difference between commitment and attachment, or commitment and holding. You know, so one can, and this ties into the aspiration. You know, one can have a commitment. It's like a relationship. You know, if one is in a relationship, one can be committed to the relationship. But without a commitment, without an attachment to the person staying the way you want them to stay, right? So that's the holding in an unskillful way, and yet there's a commitment to the ups and downs of the relationship. And so just in the examples you gave, for example, if we're trying to cultivate concentration, there can be a commitment to that practice, you know, and that state of mind. But if we're attached to it, or holding it, then in the process of training, when there are many ups and downs to the concentration, to the degree that we're attached to it staying a certain way, it's going to be frustrating, you know. But that doesn't imply not having the commitment to the practice of it and letting it develop naturally.
I know.
So I don't really see any contradiction there.
I know one teacher who said that expectations are just pre-planned resentments, which I enjoy.
Yeah, that's a great line. So. Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right.
And so, Joseph, you've been really generous with your time. And I have two more questions, sort of completely unrelated to each other. But one is, bridging from this concept of commitment, you've taught the Dhamma with a commitment to doing it purely. And in terms of aligning that teaching with a skillful, sustainable, and ethical commitment to Dhamma, what advice would you give the sort of burgeoning lay teachers in the U.S. right now? I mean, the monastics have a fairly clear directive on this, but for retreat centers or lay teachers, how much vulnerability is necessary before the world answers you, or how do you hold that commitment to offering these teachings in an ethical way?
It's complex because as lay teachers living in the world, people are living in very different circumstances. So I'm single, and that makes it easier. If people have families, there are many more requirements. It's not infrequently that even when teachings are offered on a Dhamma basis, it's not enough for people to live on. So then it's a question of, okay, well, how do I manage this? You know, it's a real life situation. And it's been handled in different ways by different people. Some just have other jobs, you know, to help support them. But of course, that also means that they don't have as much time available for teaching. So there's a trade-off there. There are some situations where teachers get like an honorarium or a stipend. So one could see that as Dhamma from the institution, but it's not exactly the same as Dhamma offered by the students, you know, at the end of a retreat. But I don't see anything necessarily problematic in that. It's just another way of sustaining financial viability. I think the key question is really motivation, you know, and is one doing it for the money? Or is one really offering the teachings freely and then trying to figure out how to have one's life sustainable? And this takes a lot of honesty, you know, it's not always easy to discern one's motivations, and motivations can also be mixed, you know, where we see, but that itself becomes its own practice. I'll just share one motivation story, which showed me how subtle it can be. So this was time when I was practicing in India, in Bodh Gaya. I would be sometimes just in the bazaar buying some fruit, something. And in India, as people who've been there know, they're just beggars all around. And so I'm buying some food from, you know, in the bazaar, and this little beggar boy comes up with his hand out. And so I just give him a piece of fruit. And it was totally no big deal. You know, there was nothing. It just was a spontaneous moment. But then something really interesting happened. He just walked away without any acknowledgement at all. not a smile, not a nod of the head. And I was not expecting an effusive thanks for a piece of fruit. But what I didn't realize was that I had any expectation at all. You know, and to say, oh, I gave him the fruit. Oh, he didn't even acknowledge it. You know, it surprised, it revealed to me that even in that very spontaneous moment, you know, where I didn't give it any thought, I just did it. But underneath, there was just this little sliver of an expectation of response. So it revealed to me that watching our motivations carefully is its own practice. And with regard to your question and the teaching and the whole Dhamma system and the issue of money for lay people, it requires a lot of care, you know, so that we're really watching.
Thank you.
I think it's not to have necessarily the expectation, as I found out in that situation, that we'll always be perfectly pure in our motivations. But we can aim for it. That can be our aspiration. And then work when we see where it's not so pure, you know, and to be able to do that without self-judgment, you know, it's an exploration, it's an investigation and part of our practice.
So I just, at the beginning of One Dharma, you dedicate the book to your various different teachers. You mention Anagarika Munindra, Goenkaji, Dipama, Sasaki Roshi, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Mahasi Sayadaw Upandita, 16th Karmapa, Dilwa Kensei, Bhikkhu Urgyen Rinpoche. And
I hit them all.
It's a great list. And just hearing some of your stories with them are fantastic. I am curious, though, what you do if it seems like, you know, we've got Zen teachers in there, very traditional Theravada teachers in there, and Dzogchen Tibetan teachers. What do you do if it seems like some of the teachings, possibly even sutras, seem to contradict or say something opposite to the suttas, or if a teacher suggests something that, say, we're already perfect, everything is perfect as it is? You know, how do you reconcile that with a Theravada understanding that actually, no, we're in samsara and we need to get out?
Well, in one way, that was the motivation for writing One Dharma. You know, when I was trying to, I was confronted with that very thing, where different traditions were saying quite different things about the ultimate nature of reality. And at least at that time, and to some extent even now, my resolution of it after tormenting myself with that question was to see all teachings as skillful means rather than as statements of absolute truth. So then the question, skillful means for what? And what I came to at that time, and I think it's still mostly true, all the Buddhist traditions, I think, would agree in the teaching of liberation through non-clinging. So even if the metaphysics are different and the descriptions of the mind are different, and if they're seen as skillful means, then one could simply ask the question, well, does that teaching result in not clinging or not? So that becomes the measure, not the particular statements, the metaphysical statements. So I think there is a way of beginning to take what's of value in the different traditions and still stay aligned with one's basic understanding. You know, just hear a teaching, okay, does this help me free the mind from grasping? Does this help free the mind from grasping? If yes, it's probably a good thing. If no, can let that one go. So that's basically how I hold it.
Just to circle back around, I appreciated your answer to the question about stages of enlightenment. And when you said basically that it is possible to look at that a little bit more, I've heard speculation that, so for people, in last century or previous centuries, things were so easy, especially in like an agrarian or rural culture. Life is very simple and it's easier for people to get concentrated and get deep states of samadhi and meditation. And so it's easier for Asian people. And I'm curious if you've probably taught, just about as many Westerners as anybody else. And do you find that there are Americans, Westerners who are experiencing these deeper states and stages of awakening?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, as I say, I wouldn't say it's common, but it's not totally uncommon. There are definitely beings, and it's interesting because it also points to, in my mind, the whole notion of parami, and there are some Westerners who just have these paramis. I call them naturals. I had a struggle, with catching up to that early experience, the catching up part. It took a long time, but there are just some people who pretty easily settle into a concentrated state and go through the different stages of insight, and it's beautiful. It's beautiful to see them. Yeah, and there are. I know many Westerners who have quite extraordinary practices.
Mm-hmm. Joseph, I think you're one of the few teachers who's had the kind of breadth of experience talking to different practitioners in the West and elsewhere to be able to kind of give encouragement in this way. And it's worth a lot. So we've kept you for a long time. We so appreciate you spending the time with us. And just once again, want to, we came to Seattle 3 years ago and were met by a culture which actually had begun to understand these teachings and hear them and know them. And we're indebted to you and that first wave of teachers for all that. So thank you so much for taking the time.
No, you're very welcome. And I'm glad you're carrying it on.
Yeah. Visit us in Seattle sometime if you ever get a chance.
Yeah. Great. Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.